Of course, the experiences of fate and fortune did not go away, but they cannot be addressed in the official theology other than within the context of divine providence. Thomas Aquinas confirms this in his questions 116 in the first part of his Summa Theologiae. Divination as a practice of coping with fate, of course, was practiced in Europe throughout the Middle Ages, and it was certainly based on some degree of theoretical reflection. We know that occasionally the same popes who condemned divination in public practiced it in private. But as a consequence of the doctrinal development, the dealings with fate and prognostication were frequently pushed into the corner of superstition, if not heterodoxy. While in China they were a part of the official culture, subject to various philosophical schools, and, as I learned, even an integral part of the imperial administration. This may account for the higher level of sophistication that the theory and practice of divination has reached in China in this period. However, the situation in Europe changed decisively in the later Middle Ages, when, as a result of the Great Schism and other developments, the doctrinal authority of the Catholic clergy is waning. Already in the 14th century, for instance, in the writings of Francesco Petrarca, the topics of fortune and fate massively return to the center of reflection on the human situation. This development gains momentum in the 15th century and results in institutions like the Academy of Florence, where the philosophical discussion of fortune, fate, and divination is again in the center of teaching and learning. The treatises on fate, De Fato, become a genre of their own. My presentation today may be seen as part of a much larger story, which could be entitled The Return of Fate to Western Christendom. This return, however, was only available by undermining and questioning the authority of Augustine. I will try to show that the painter Hieronymus Bosch is taking part in this process. Bosch, to be sure, was a devout Catholic. He carefully studied Augustine and followed him more than any other European painter. But he also insisted on the existence of a dimension which Augustine had denied, the dimension of faith. The specific type of faith I'm addressing here is not individual faith, but the faith of mankind in general, which all humans share because of their common ancestors Adam and Eve. To what extent this universal understanding of fate has parallels in China, I'm not competent to say. But if I understand the work of my colleague and office mate Scott Davis correctly, then Chinese divination very well contains an element of this philosophical anthropology and general reflection about the situation of man. However, the practical dimension within which I want to discuss the concept of fate today is not divination, but painting. So let us turn to Bosch. Maybe you can switch off the light, because you don't have to see me, but the pictures are right there. Thank you. What you can see here is the exterior panels of Hieronymus Bosch's masterpiece, The Garden of Earthly Delights. Evidently, in a closed condition, the triptych does not show much delight at all. What we see instead is a grayish, pre-Copernican representation of the cosmos, the yet unfinished cosmos on the third or fourth day of creation. We see the Earth as a flat disk contained in a glass-like sphere. This is probably an allusion to Psalm 33, which says that God gathers together all the waters of the sea in a bottle. The same psalm is also quoted in the inscription on the painting here on the top, which reads, Ipse dixit et facta sunt, ipse mandavit et creata sunt. He spoke and they were made, he commanded and they were created. Another main source for this painting is the book of Genesis, where we read that on the first day God created heaven and earth. On the second day God made a division between the sea and the dry land. And on the third day, I quote, the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. What we in fact see in the picture is the whole of dry land covered with exuberant vegetation, Vegetation which, according to the Bible, has an inbuilt drive to grow and multiply. It is not clearly discernible if the fourth day, the creation of the stars, has already passed. Yes, undoubtedly, this is a decisive moment in God's work. In Bosch's painting, it almost seems as if the creator is hesitating for a moment to rethink the next step.
You see God here in this upper left corner. And it's to show you a close-up of God.
But of course, the next steps are already determined in God's eternal plan. The script for the creation is in his hands. The next steps are the creation of animal life on day 5 and human life on day 6. Now, if we open the triptych, we can see the result. But before I open it for you, keep in mind that this opening was a ceremonial act. However, if this triptych, the Garden of Earthly Delights, could have been opened under orthodox conditions in a Christian church, is hotly debated among scholars. The interior of the triptych is one of the most enigmatic paintings in history. Hardly any other painting has provoked more literary activity than this one, and by no means all details have been decoded in a convincing way. However, some things seem to be clear. The painting has 3 parts, and as every triptych in Western Christian art, it must be read from left to right. The left panel clearly refers to the account of the Genesis, this time focusing on the 5th and 6th day of the creation. The right panel shows the punishment of the sinners in the afterlife, but what the central panel displays is entirely unclear. Let me first say a few words about the painter. Hieronymus Bosch was born in Sertogenbosch around 1450 into a well-established family.
Here you can see a present-day picture of Sertogenbosch. You can see that not much has changed since the 15th century, except for the McDonald's restaurant.
Bosch made a very swift career, and in his later period could sell his works for much higher prices than some of the Renaissance champions, such as Albrecht Dürer. He made a very fortunate marriage with the daughter of a wealthy merchant and soon was accepted into the economic and political elite of his hometown. Beyond the official magistrates, councils, and offices, this elite was organized in a religious congregation, the Brotherhood of Our Lady. The Brotherhood represented the lay piety of the rising merchant and artisan class, but also included nobility and clergy. It had thousands of members inside and outside Sertogenbosch, and most of the members of the Bosch family had joined them, if for religion or for business reasons is not entirely clear, maybe both. Yet the Brotherhood also had a very exclusive and very secretive inner circle, the Sworn Brothers, only 100 in number, who regarded themselves as the most powerful, but also the most pious people in town. Bosch accomplished to enter this inner circle a quite exceptional achievement for an artist. A surviving document shows his name and profession on the list of the inner circle. His name is still his very name, Van Aken. This secured him the support of financially strong donors. Some interpreters have made the claim that Bosch's art expresses the moral convictions of this powerful elite. And this is probably true for his middle period, when his paintings often show scenes from the life of Christ, while the donors are standing by in a pious gesture, often wearing a badge with a lily, the symbol of the Brotherhood. For instance, here in this Acte Homo Triptych. Can you see the lily and the badge of the lily on the arm? But as I think this interpretation does not work well with his later paintings, such as the Garden of Earthly Delights. In this period, Bosch was already famous, and the higher nobility would pay high prices for a Bosch painting and give him full artistic liberty. Among his customers were illustrious members from the House of Habsburg, such as Philip the Fair, King of Castile. The Garden of Earthly Delights may have been commissioned by Duke Henry III of Nassau. Yet in this period, we do not find any donor in the paintings. Instead, Bosch's sober view at Newman's situation becomes fully apparent. All humans are sinful, and the bourgeoisie, the nobility, and the clergy are explicitly included. Very little is known about Bosch's education. He certainly attended the Latin school that much is known, but what would he have read? He did not write theoretical treatises about art like his contemporaries Leonardo da Vinci and Albrecht Dürer, or if he did, they are not preserved. None of Bosch's correspondence has survived, nor any other autobiographical material. Yet it is very likely that he used the public libraries of his hometown, especially the ones of the religious communities, such as the Brethren of Common Life, who had a strong presence in Sepulveda Bosch. The Brethren were the main carriers of the Catholic reform movement commonly called the Devotio Moderna. We have reason to assume that also Hieronymus Bosch was strongly influenced by this movement, which determined the religious discourse also in the Brotherhood of Our Lady. Some of the earlier paintings of Bosch focus on the motive of devotion and the personal relation between the believer and Christ, as you can see it here in the Saint Hermann's crypt. For understanding Bosch, it is highly important to consider that the Devotio Moderna not so much recommended reading pious treatises of the period. On the contrary, it suggested to return to the Bible and the commentaries of the Church Fathers, especially Augustine. The whole tradition of scholastic theology and canon law was more or less declared irrelevant. Bosch, it seems, followed this advice. Augustine was also the patron of several religious congregations in Sertogenbosch, and as modern scholarship has shown, he held the most prominent place in practically all libraries in town. There's another reason why someone like Hieronymus Bosch would turn to the Church Father. Augustine's City of God simply is the major source for the overarching narrative framework of sacred history. Nobody invested in intellectual history, not the chroniclers, not the scholastics, not the humanists, and not the reformers, have ever provided a comprehensive account of sacred history which aimed to supersede Augustine's. On the contrary, without exception, they all relied on him. This basically changes only with the Enlightenment narratives about universal progress, as in Voltaire, or the anti-progressivist counter-narrative of Giambattista Vico. Yet in the time of Hieronymus Bosch, Augustine's account is still without alternative for everyone researching the historical existence of man. The essence of my argument is that the writings of Augustine provide the key to the larger iconographic program of Bosch's mature work. Before I will explain this in more detail, let me say a few words about the basic structure of the Augustinian narrative. The first 10 books of the City of God mainly have apologetic character and react to the sack of Rome in 410. More relevant in our context are the 12 books to follow, which contain the constructive part of the work. That is, the history of the world from the creation to the end of time. This narrative presented sacred history as the struggle of two mystical communities, the City of God and the Earthly City. The narrative is divided into three major parts, as Augustine himself explains. I quote the narrative quotation here. Of these 12 succeeding books, the first four contain the origin, ex ortus in Latin, of the two cities. The second four, their course or progress, procursus. The third and last four, their appointed ends, in Latin, debiti finis. Now the ex ortus, the origin, the beginning, or the emergence of the two cities, tells us how the fall of the angels caused the split in the community of the heavenly creatures. In order to fill the gap in the heavenly ranks, God created man. But also man fell into sinfulness, and only a few humans will be saved by the grace of God. So the elect of God, together with the loyal angels, constitute the city of God, bound together by the armor of David, the love of God, while the wicked humans, together with the fallen angels, constitute the earthly city, bound together by the armor of Sui, Solomon. Procursus, the second stage, tells us how the cities evolve in the course of history, beginning with the first representatives, the God-loving Abel, who is slain by his self-loving brother Cain, until the arrival of both cities at the end of days. The third part, David Venus, tells us about the last judgment, where the cities that have mixed in the course of history will be finally separated. The city of God enters heavenly bliss, while the earthly city faces eternal punishment in hell. Let us now return to Hieronymus Bosch. He created three triptychs, which are commonly regarded as his masterpieces. The Garden of Earthly Delights, now on display in the Museo del Prado in Madrid. The Haven, also in the collection of the Prado. And the Last Judgment, now in the Academy of Biblical Kunst in Vienna. Other than most of the surviving works of Bosch, all the three of them do not represent the life of saints, nor do they show episodes from the Gospels, nor do they have a specific moral content, such as the seven deadly sins, nor do they show any individual person. All three of them take a view at the human fate in general. Recently, Bosch experts have suggested the label eschatological works for these three paintings, but this is an unjustified overstretch of the concept of eschatology. Out of the three master triptychs, only the Last Judgment displays an eschatological motif on its central panel. Instead, I suggest speaking of Bosch's works on the human fate. Before I come to the details, let me make the point that all the three triptychs show the same basic pattern. On the left panels, we see the Garden of Eden, and on the right panels, we see Hell. The details differ, but the basic motifs remain the same. Only the central panel shows the human situation at different moments. And these situations, I claim, agree exactly with this basic structure of Augustine's City of God. The Last Judgment clearly refers to Augustine's Debiti Finis, the end of human history, where everybody arrives at his or her deserved end. If, for the moment, we focus only on the central panel, we see Christ as a judge. His right hand is pointing upward to show the way of the city of God. His left hand is pointing downward to indicate the fate of the earthly city. What is displayed in the lower part of the picture is the purgatory, and in the background, the deeper pits of hell. According to a very commonly accepted idea expressed already in the second century by the theologian Tertullian, the tortures in the purgatory would exactly mirror the deeds of the sinners. Here, for instance, we see how gluttony is punished by a very hellish drink made of excrements, or by being fried by demonic cannibals. Oh, that's exceptional. Or we see here, in this close-up, how vanity is punished by attracting the lustful glances of rather uncanny creatures. We also see a person being released from the purgatory and taken away by a heavenly messenger. While even in this moment, a demon is trying to assassinate either the man or the angel. And in a very remote distance, a few blessed ones are entering the heavenly sphere. It's hardly visible in the picture in the original sense. Clearly, Bosch is following the Augustinian calculation about the number of the elect. We see only a small group assembled in heaven, while the huge mass of people is going to hell. Here, we see the Haven, the triptych devoted to Augustine's second stage of prochoresis. The main symbol we find in Augustine for human existence at this stage is pilgrimage. And if we close the triptych for a moment and look at the exterior panels, the motive of pilgrimage is fully apparent. One single upright man is desperately trying to pursue the right path, despite all the dangers and distractions. On the side of the way, we see crimes and sins of all kinds, murder, robbery, adultery, and in the background, a huge crowd assembles to enjoy a public execution. In contrast to the single man who is on his pilgrimage towards salvation, the mass of the humans are on their course toward hell. The haven symbolizes the vanity of the great world, a topic prominent in Augustine's City of God, just as much as in the main treatise of the Devotio Moderna, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas Aquinas. The hell itself symbolizes the illusionary value of this worldly pursuits, such as career, wealth, social status, political power, bodily pleasures, and so forth. And with brutal irony, Bosch shows how people are killing each other for a bunch of hay. Nobody, really nobody, is excluded from the pursuit of hay. Members from all social standing join the procession. The emperor and pope, as the heads of the temporal and the spiritual government, are found just in the middle of the crowd, mindlessly following their hayway. The guides who determine the hellbound direction of the carriage are demons. They are omnipresent in Bosch's work. According to Christian teaching, the essential character of the demon is deception. He deceives the humans by giving them wrong goals in life, by inciting their desires for power, possession, and sex. Not a single person is looking upward to Christ, the real goal of human life. Christ shows the stigmata, the signs of his sacrifice for mankind, but he is totally ignored. Hate, on the other hand, signifies the short-term pleasures of this life that sooner or later dissolves into nothingness, while Christ signifies eternal life. But as it seems, not a single human being is willing to deviate from their sinful course. As often, Bosch gives a special emphasis on the behavior of nuns and monks. We observe them as they collect the biggest of all hay bunches. Bosch's contempt for the clergy and the monks is fairly typical for the contemporary lay religiosity, including the Devotio Moderna. The lay piety of the 15th century is largely the outcome of the Great Schism, which destroyed the remaining trust in the saving power of the clergy and its sacraments. More and more believers were seeking for alternative ways to secure their redemption. Usually, this meant distrust in the priesthood and a personalization and internalization of piety. Lay people founded a large number of smaller or larger congregations, such as the Brotherhood of Our Lady. The church, however, was afraid that such religious lay communities might easily fall into heresies. And some of them, in fact, did. Therefore, usually monastic orders were commissioned with the supervision of these lay communities. In the case of Bosch's Brotherhood, it was the Dominican Friars. In the eyes of many members of these communities, that was equal to commissioning wolves with the supervision of sheep. In the pride about their pious achievements, which often blended with pride about economic achievements, they looked down on clerics and monks who often displayed a much more dubious moral life. When Bosch, for instance, became a sworn member of the Brotherhood of Our Lady, he had to take a vow to remain eternally faithful to his wife. Yet in this time, we frequently hear the complaint that clerics and monks preach the value of marriage, while their own concubines constantly change. Sexuality in general is a dominant theme in Hieronymus Bosch. He did not believe that something like innocent love was possible in this life. On the top of the hayman, and quite prominent in the general design of the painting, we see a loving couple in a seemingly harmonious scene. They are singing a few songs together, but the demon of lust is already standing next to them and playing along. And in the next moment, they disappear in the bushes. With this scene in mind, we may now finally turn to the most famous triptych, The Garden of Earthly Delights. As I have tried to show, the master triptychs follow the tripartite narrative of sacred history as found in Augustine's City of God. In our retrogressive contemplation, we have now reached the first stage, the ex ortus, the origin of mankind. As I would like to claim, the central panel shows us nothing else but mankind in the Garden of Eden before the fall, a human society in the state of nature, yet at the same time a paradise on the verge of collapse. Similar suggestions have been made earlier, but have all been rejected by most leading scholars today. In a 2001 monograph on Bosch by the American scholar Larry Silver, we read that we can clearly see typical features of the Garden of Eden in the picture, but because of the obvious sexual acts occurring in the image, we are dealing with a post-lapsarian representation of Eden. Unfortunately, this is plain nonsense. A post-lapsarian Eden is a contradiction in terms. The biblical account clearly says that the expulsion from Eden is an immediate consequence of the fall. The whole narrative would become meaningless if post-lapsarian mankind would continue to live in paradise. The German art historian Stefan Fischer, in a very recent 2009 monograph, insists on a moral interpretation and claims that we are seeing a perversion of divine order, a mock version of paradise with pedagogical intent. 10 years earlier, the Dutch Bosch expert Roger Marinissen rejected the Garden of Eden interpretation by saying, I quote, "I personally do not see what paragraph of Genesis one could refer to for speaking about paradisiacal life of mankind before the fall. In any case, Adam and Eve were all alone." This is basically correct. According to the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve were alone. They committed the original sin, and consequently they were expelled from Eden. But the statement of this Dutch scholar also shows the frequent theological illiteracy of modern art historians. Everyone familiar with the writings of the Church Fathers knows that they're almost obsessed with speculations about the question, what would have human existence have looked like if Adam had not sinned? This question is of high systematic necessity, as it asks what God originally wanted human society to look like. In Christian political thought, the speculation about pre-lapsarian human life in paradise has aimed at establishing an ideal picture to which the actual post-lapsarian society could be compared. The legacy of these political speculations we can still trace in the representations of the natural state by Enlightenment thinkers such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau or John Locke. An extensive speculation of this kind we find again in Augustine's City of God. And because I think that the main message of Bosch's painting lies in a careful but decisive deviation from Augustine, I first give the account of the Church Father. Augustine tells us that man was originally created in the likeness of God. That is, his reason had total control over the passions and all lower functions of the body, just as God, the supreme reason, rules over the lower beings of the universe. The Church Father portrays a Stoic background when he describes the original condition of man as apatheia, as the absence of effects, literally summa infame sanitas in animo tota tranquillitas, a completely healthy flesh and an absolute peace of mind. Politically, this means a total absence of government, says Augustine. Since we read in the book of Genesis that God gave to man the dominion over all other creatures, but nowhere do we read that he gave to humans the dominion over other humans. This, of course, was not necessary in paradise, because reason endowed the humans with the natural law spelled out in the Golden Rule. Don't do unto others what you don't want others to do unto you. The Golden Rule was perfectly sufficient for organizing social life, which then basically consisted of the natural union of wife and husband. I quote, "Between husband and wife, there was a loyal partnership springing from honest love. There was a harmonious alertness of mind and body, and an effortless observance of God's command." But what about sex? How did humans multiply if they were not guided by their passions and instincts as the animals? Augustine gives us a clear answer, and I give you a full quote because it's my favorite quote from Augustine. "Marriage, worthy of the happiness of paradise, should have had desirable fruit without the shame of lust, had there been no sin. But how that could be, there is no example to teach us. Nevertheless, it ought not to seem incredible that one member," he's speaking of the penis, "might serve the will without lust then. Since so many serve it now, do we now move our feet and hands when we will do the things we would by means of these members? May we not similarly believe that those sexual organs could, like the others, have served mankind by obedience to the decision of the will for the generation of children, even if there had been no lust inflicted as punishment for the sin of disobedience? Under those circumstances, the organ created for this work would have sown its seed upon the field of generation, as the hand does now upon the earth." End of quote. In other words, sexual intercourse in paradise was a fully rational act. Only when, as a result of original sin, humans lost their rational control over the passions, sexuality became determined by concupiscencia, by sexual lust. And this exactly is the point where Borsch differs from the classical account of the church fall. Let me illustrate my argument by returning to the three triptychs. As we have seen, all the three show the Garden of Eden on the left panel. Now, with modern technology, let me make a trick. I take all of the left panels of the Garden of Eden and put them next to each other. Both representations of the Garden of Eden in the Heirloom and the Last Judgment show the typical motifs: the fall of the angels, the creation and blessing of Adam and Eve, the seduction by the serpent and the eating of the forbidden fruit, and the expulsion from paradise. The left panel of the Garden of Earthly Delights, however, differs decisively. The cosmological myth of the fall of the angels is completely cut out. Neither the fall nor the expulsion from paradise is depicted. Instead, the image focuses on the creation of animals and humans on the fifth and sixth day of God's work. Let us now look at the left panel in more detail. We see how life emerges from God's creation. Birds are flying up into the sky. Various animals drinking the water of life. And all kinds of reptiles are creeping out of the water and entering land. But if you look a bit closer, we can recognize that some things are somewhat disturbing. The birds are black and white. Yet in Bosch's painting, blackbirds are the typical inhabitants of hell. Moreover, some of the creeping animals clearly show their formation at this point. At the bottom of the picture, you see a dark pond, which seems to bring forth all kinds of uncanny creatures, including
a scholastic fish.
Yet, there are many more elements in the picture that disturb the idyllic atmosphere. In the background, a deer is killed by some predator animal. It's very small here. Another scene clearly implies aggressive behavior. Somewhat hidden but clearly discernible is another scene of killing with the cat and mouse. And what you see here is a downright massacre, where it is not even clear if the killing is necessary for the survival of this bird, or if it is killing, if it is killing just for pleasure. Placed exactly in the center of the picture is the fountain of life. In the middle of it, there's a strange form, a kind of mixture between a plant and a monstrance.
Yes, just show a picture of a random monstrance from that period, so you see the similarity in shape.
This figure seems to represent life itself, as it combines the pinkish color of human flesh with the shape of a plant and the ceremonial vessel containing the vivifying body of Christ. Yet exactly in the round-shaped container where, in a monstrance, the Eucharist is kept, an owl is hidden. Can you see it? In Bosch, the owl does not mean wisdom. It signifies seduction. This is related to bird hunting practices of the time, where an owl was glued to a tree as a kind of bait. The singing birds, recognizing the chance to hurt an enemy, would attack the owl and themselves get caught in the glue spread on the branches. This combination of singing birds signifying desires and the owl as the seducing but misleading goal of their desires is a frequent motive in Bosch's painting. I showed you just a few of them, but it also shows this hunting practices. This one you have seen already, this picture, but you probably have not recognized the bird and the owl. Here on the right, you see the same motive in several drawings of Bosch. But what is the significance of the owl and the birds in the center of the fountain of life? Does it mean that seduction and desire are essential parts of life? The scene in the foreground shows us the moment after Eve has been created from Adam's rib. Adam, just awakening from anesthesia, is somehow confusedly looking at this new female fellow, not quite knowing what to do with her. But God instantaneously gives the answer. I quote from the Bible. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. So the multiplication, which is only possible through the sexual act, is willed by God. But how would it work? In the same way as Augustine describes it, exactly at this time, Bosch decided to disagree. Let us look a bit closer at the faces of Adam and Eve. They quite typically represent what Bosch thought were the basic character traits of men and women. The woman, seemingly devout with downcast eyes, but also with an inscrutable Mona Lisa-like smile, as if she couldn't wait to start the business of multiplying. The man, rather stupid, and ready to walk into every trap set by the woman. Many interpreters have called Bosch a misogynist. Maybe so, but this is only true if you prefer male stupidity over female cunning. However, the most subversive element in the picture is the little rat next to Eve. I call it the deconstructivist rat. But what does it signify? I think simply one thing. Bosch did not wish to make such a huge difference between humans and other living creatures, as Augustine did. Plants and animals, especially rabbits, have an inbuilt drive toward multiplications. This is the law of nature. And there is no reason, Bosch seems to say, why in the state of nature, man should be so totally exempt from it. Let us just summarize at this point that Borsche's representation of paradise is deeply ambiguous. Now let me return to my argument that the central panel shows how mankind would have lived in paradise if Adam and Eve had not sinned. My first point is that the fall is not depicted as in Borsche's other paintings of paradise. My second point is that there is an obvious continuity of landscape from the left panel to the central panel, while the right panel is in this respect totally disconnected. My third point is that the central panel shows the typical elements of paradise. We see the four rivers, as described in the Genesis, Kishon, Gihon, Tigris, and Euphrates. That everyone is naked and not showing any shame. All persons seem to have perfectly shaped bodies, and everybody seems to be in their early 20s. As described by the church body, nobody is experiencing any cold or heat. The weather is always pleasant. Nobody needs to work, and nobody needs to sleep. What could be more idyllic than a young man plucking flowers from his friend's backside? And there seems to be an abundance of food. Over-dimensioned fruits are growing on the trees all around. The idea of giant grapes and other giant fruits in paradise seems to come from another early Christian writer, Irenaeus of Lyon. In the far distance, we see a person being lifted up into heaven, exactly like Augustine describes it. Here, see, it goes up. Before the fall, Augustine writes, there was no mortality. After a certain testing period, humans would have taken off to heaven without undergoing death and resurrection. Finally, one of the clearest signs is the absence of Christ, probably because there is not yet any necessity for a savior. The narrative in the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans tells us that Christ came into the world as a result of Adam's sin, as a second Adam, who would restore mankind. If the painting shows, as I think, a prelapsary situation, then the absence of Christ is plausible. But what about sexuality? Do we really see the orgiastic sexuality that many interpreters have observed and that let them reject the idea of a prelapsary mankind? Let me show you some close-ups of the loving couples in the picture. It rather seems to me that we are observing the type of innocent, paradisiacal love that Augustine described, or in Irenaeus of Lyon. I quote, they were not ashamed, kissing and embracing each other in purity after the manner of children. Childishness, in fact, is a keyword. Since Bosch, as a painter, also had to ask the question what people were doing all day in paradise if there was neither work nor sleep. And what the humans in paradise are doing are mostly utterly childish things. Like children on a playground, they would try to climb every tree and engage in gymnastic exercise. It's all here, or in the background, Joseph, you must see it. But what if these exercises get boring? Would they not invent increasingly silly games? Undeniably, the wildest scene is placed in the center of the picture. The chase of the young man around the pool of the girls. As it seems, there is a strict gender separation in the game and no orgiastic intermingling, as some more Puritan interpreters came to see. However, the painting has more than just one dimension. Occasionally, one can hear almost observe the painter thinking by looking at the picture. Apparently, Bosch was asking himself, why did Adam fall? How could he fall? Now, what does Augustine say? Adam could fall because he was endowed with free will. So he could freely obey God's command, but also follow his lower desires. But when he sinned, he was deprived of his free will. Instead, he is now dominated by his passions and may only be saved by the grace of God. Well, Bosch seems to ask, if Adam had not sinned, and mankind would have multiplied in paradise, would not the situation of Adam always remain the same? would then not all humans still be endowed with free will? But this would mean that the paradox would remain a terribly fragile situation. And this is exactly what Bosch wants to show us, and what is not at all considered in Augustine's account. The fragility is depicted in a variety of ways, and apparently Bosch wanted to show us exactly the moment of collapse. These close-ups of the chicks around the pool show that some of the ladies are about to fall into the deadly sin of superbia, of pride. The peacock is a traditional symbol of pride and vanity, and so is the apple, alluding simultaneously to the beauty contest in Homer's Iliad and Eve's loss of innocence. One young lady is already leaving the pool and heading toward the young man. Many of the animals on which the men are riding have swollen testicles, signaling sexual readiness. Let us look again at one of the loving couples. They seem to be safe in a sphere surrounding them, but the sphere visibly has cracks. All over the picture, we see the motive of the owl and the birds. In Bosch's logic, that can only mean that seduction and vain desires are lurking everywhere. Three dancing men seem to have one single head in the shape of an owl. One man is happily embracing the owl. And some participants in the chase around the pool have just spotted the owl and, as it were, are agreeing to target it. However, the full ambiguity of the painting becomes apparent if we have a close look at the center right section. As it is clearly discernible, one of the animals, ridden by an ecstatic young man, has a phallus-shaped head. This seems to me almost like a counterstatement to Augustine's idea of a rationally operated sexual organs in paradise. We see one couple, maybe dancing, but the guilty face of the man and the scared face of the woman could almost express that what is going on here is not completely consensual. The unhealthy body color of men eating grapes, you can see here, shows that the abundance of food may have caused their fall into gluttony, another deadly sin. And one man seems to have fallen into a state of melancholy, in Bosch's time often associated with the deadly sin of sloth. And there is a number of rather gloomy looking men in the background, who seemingly were not so lucky in finding a mating partner. They seem to look at the playful happiness of paradise with some degree of envy. So only in this small section of the Garden of Eden, the beginnings of four of the seven deadly sins are depicted: pride, gluttony, sloth, and envy. Yet the clearest scene of unrestrained sexual lust, the most deadly of all sins, is also the most hidden scene in the picture. It is not even easy to see if you stand right in front of the picture. In a cave, in the geographic center of paradise, from where the four living fire rivers spring, we observe a scene which is downright pornographic. A bearded and uncivilized looking man is going directly for the most private parts of a seemingly surprised and shocked young lady. And if you look at it very carefully, you see the uncanny face of another human looking man approaching from behind. This scene does not at all display the innocent type of love, which is placed more in the foreground of the picture. In this scene, the fall of man has already happened. Let me come to my final evaluation of the painting. From the earliest beginnings of Western Latin Christianity, the situation of man has been expressed in legal terms. In the Latin translations, the language of the gospel underwent a juridification. A perfect example is the concept of sin. What in the Greek New Testament was called hamartia, failure or deviation, was translated into Latin as peccatum, crime. But also the whole narrative of human historical existence was translated into judicial proceedings by the Latin fathers. Augustine provided a paradigmatic formulation, but it has been confirmed by the Catholic theologian Thomas Aquinas, just as much as by the Protestant lawyer Charles Calvin. Adam had sinned voluntarily against the divine law, and since he was the ancestor of mankind, all mankind has sinned in him. Mankind is a sinful mass, a massa peccati, as Augustine calls it. Therefore, all humans are justifiably punished, not only by a miserable earthly existence, but also by eternal chastisement in the beyond. If some humans are exempted from punishment, this is only due to a totally undeserved act of grace from the side of God, the Supreme Judge. Augustine also said that on Judgment Day, when we will look back on the course of human history, every detail of it, every disease, every war, every disaster, everything that might appear tragic or fatal to us now, will then be known as just and absolutely necessary. If I read Bosch's painting correctly, then he is reintroducing into the Christian narrative a dimension of human existence that has been abolished by the church fall, the dimension of faith and treasure. The dimension is essential for the representation of human existence in the arts, in painting, and in drama. Therefore, we often find a protest against the rigid judicial logic of the Augustinian paradigm in the works of religiously sensitive poets, such as John Milton or Johann Wolfgang Goethe. These poets did not aim at the total rejection of the Augustinian paradigm, as in Enlightenment philosophy. These poets, rather, just like Remigius Bosch, follow the Augustinian narrative, but modified by reintroducing the dimension of faith. That means, more precisely, that they doubt the full legal culpability of man. They are not Gnostics in the sense that they describe the creation as evil throughout. No. As we have seen, they rather detect some ambivalence, some ambiguity in the original condition of divine creation. In the details, of course, they differ. In Milton and Goethe, man is created with an inborn curiosity and desire to know. Therefore, he was determined to eat the forbidden fruit. In Bosch, the emphasis is on human sexuality. Man would not have been able to fulfill the divine command to multiply if he had not fully participated in the drives, instincts, and desires of living nature. Yet this implies that the desires could at any time degenerate into lust and unrestrained passion. If Adam had not sinned, somebody else had done it sooner or later. In other words, in Bosch's representation of human sinfulness, there is a sense of inevitable fate. And therefore, the miserable, laborious, and vain character of human life, just as much as the tortures of the beyond, are not simply justified punishments. They are a fatal consequence of creation, and they are also a tragedy. This, however, sheds new light on the character of God. He foresaw the fate of mankind, but not in the sense of providence. God rather willingly accepted the human fate as a necessary consequence of his will, even though he may have recently hesitated on the third day of creation. But the Christian God, that is not only the Father, the Creator, he is also the Son, the Savior. And if we, for a moment, look at the representations of God in Bosch's painting, we may detect a difference in character. We see a detached Father and a concerned Son. The Father remains eternally in his transcendent immutability while the Son becomes man. You can see here the fall of the angels, thousands of angels falling, the Father is unmoved. Contrary to the letter of the Genesis, Bosch's painting makes the Son appear in paradise and not the Father. The Son is speaking the blessing of Adam. This should be a happy moment, but his face expression could not be more concerned. Christ knows exactly what is coming. and is looking directly into the eyes of the viewer, almost as if to say, sorry. Bosch's Christ is a much more human Christ than the Christ of Augustine. It is the Christ of the Devotio Moderna, a Christ who has sacrificed himself out of compassion for mankind. He is human and feels with humans. This does not imply a rebellion against the Father, but an attempt to modify the rigid script of the Father. It is an attempt to provide a way out for the ones who acknowledge the sacrificial character of incarnation, passion, and crucifixion. For the ones who are willing to imitate Christ and willingly accept suffering. Therefore, Bosch's Christ almost desperately shows the stigmata, the visible signs of his sacrifice. Yet the second part of the tragedy is the fate of Christ, whose sacrifice is largely ignored by the humans, as depicted in the triptych of the Hagar. If this character difference between the Father and the Son, between the Creator and the Savior, would have been expressed in the written word, in a theological treatise, would have been suspicious. In theological terminology, a difference in character would inevitably become a difference in essence, which is heresy. But the painter has different means, can allow for more ambiguity and leave more room for interpretation. Let me conclude. What I see in the three master triptychs of Hieronymus Bosch, and particularly in the Garden of Earthly Lights, is the attempt of a partial exoneration of man from the guilt of original sin. Humans fell into sin, but they fell in their capacity as divine creatures. God certainly created the best of all possible worlds, but it still contained the seeds of fallibility. If I'm right, Hieronymus Bosch is part of a long tradition of Christian thinkers and artists who did not, as Augustine, aim at the defense of God in the face of evil and suffering, but who were rather aiming at the defense of man in the face of sinfulness. Bosch does not look at the human fate primarily as a deserved punishment for original sin, but rather as a tragic consequence of the inevitable fall of man. And since traditionally a sense of tragedy comes also with a sense of comedy, we can now enjoy Bosch's vision of the playful foolishness of original mankind, if it only had been granted some more time in paradise. Thank you very much.